Zero seven nine. Let us all bring our palms together to make our veneration to the perfect one, the undefeated one, the unvanquished one, the infinitely compassionate one, the Supreme Buddha. Let us also remind ourselves that this is not a mere mark of our veneration and our obeisance, but a renewal of our pledge of allegiance and a steadfast commitment to attaining the supreme bliss of Nibbana as we cross the path and make this opportunity available to others along the way. So with that in mind, let us remind ourselves that the only refuge we have as sentient beings is the refuge of the Noble Triple Gem. Let us bring our palms together to chant the Namaskara, seek refuge in the Noble Triple Gem, observe the precepts, invite the celestial beings, all sentient beings, to be present and to be here with us, to listen to the teaching of the Great Master, to rejoice in the merits as they are about to unfold. And with that, we will make a start to today's proceedings. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. The problem that we're all trying to tackle is suffering in its many forms. We have all lived long enough to have been a victim of this suffering. The thing is, too often we think that suffering comes to us from outside, external. That there are individuals who bring us suffering. That there are things, objects or events that cause us suffering. So we spend a whole lifetime, ladies and gentlemen, trying to remove these sources of suffering that we think are there outside of us, to wait them off and to try and remove them from our lives so that we can maintain a state of happiness. Until we see that there's a fundamental problem here, we will continue to do this. The happiness that you have always experienced is a happiness that you've had to maintain. Now, as you listen to this, I want you to go into your own lives, the journey that you have taken to this point, and the various ups and downs that you've had to go through in life. Because each of you will have a very unique story. There's no one else in this room who knows your story better than you. So for each of you, you have a unique story. A story from whenever you can remember, perhaps from when you were very young, to where you are now. The various vicissitudes of life, the various atrocities that you've had to face, adversities that you've had to overcome. Yes, it would have been sprinkled with some goodness, some fortunate events, but there were always some misfortunate, unfortunate events along the way as well. So every time you came across one of these misfortunate, unfortunate events, you were so determined that you will not let that happen to you again. That is how life was always. So you tried to learn, you tried to teach yourself how to avoid these misfortunate, unfortunate things from happening to you. And this is what we call education. We educate ourselves so that we can keep these unfortunate events away from us and always try and make our lives happy and keep those fortunate events coming to us and repeating themselves. As an example, when someone disappoints you, anyone here who's not had that experience? Just let me know, I will make sure that you get one. All of us have been on the receiving end of that, haven't we? Yes. So when someone disappoints you, you try and learn about that person. You try and study that person, don't you? You try and predict their next move. You try and learn how to predict their next move so that you don't fall into that same place again. So you think to yourself, right, so the last time they gave me a promise and they never fulfilled it, so the next time round, I'm going to have some backup plan. And then if they do it, get away with it once or twice, then you sort of put them into your blacklist and say, right, this guy, don't trust him. Don't trust that guy. Because whenever he says he will do it, chances are he won't. So now you have a list of people. You know, you don't publish it out because it would be embarrassing. And at the same time, you want everyone to think that you're their friend and they're yours. So all these people who we have unfriended, right? It's all only, it's very personal, right? You don't publish that list out. But most people have that, unfriended individuals. So we go from being friends to, shall we say, acquaintances. We know them, but we don't want to know them. But we do. And as I say, keep your friends close, but your enemies closer. So those are very close, so close that no one else knows. But the reason you do this is so that you can protect yourself from future harm, damage. You're designed in this manner. This is part and parcel of your construct. You're engineered to be like that. So this is a school about yourself. Right? We are here to study us. How do I work and why do I work in that way? So this is not a Dhamma school. Although we call it a Dhamma sermon, this is a school about you. Because there are often times when you don't know why you do things the way you do. There are often times when you have emotions, feelings, things that you feel and you struggle to understand why you feel that way. And sometimes those are feelings you're not very proud of, but they come to you nonetheless. Like when you see someone get something that you don't get, and you feel, oh, how I wish I had that. But you never spit it out, do you? These are things that you cannot say. You don't like to say it out because it would be rude. It would not be polite to be saying such a thing, but you feel it anyway. It's like if you see someone, like gents, you see a lady. What? Let me finish the sentence. You see a lady and you think she's alright. Alright, she's alright. You think she's alright, but she's already taken. Then what do? Oh, there are so many things you wish you could say, but you can't. So you have to keep hush. Because such things are not appropriate. See, the thing is this. All these inappropriate things, they keep coming into your mind. Even though you know it's not appropriate. But you can't stop them. And so you suffer silently. This silent suffering, aren't you sick of it? Haven't you had enough of it? Silent suffering. You go through this day in, day out, don't you? Every day of your life, somewhere down the line, you always have to endure this. This silent suffering. Things that you wish you could just express, get it out of your system, vent it out, but you can't. Then there are times when you don't like people. People you really don't like. People you don't like to be in the presence of, let alone hold hands with. But what can you do? You and they have both been invited to the party. The last thing you want is to be sat next to that person, but hey ho, what does the host do? This is the thing. You know, all these tribulations, all these animosities, you know, you don't express them. It's all inside, right? You put it in a deep, you know, in a closet and keep it locked. No one else knows about this. So you don't express it, so therefore the host cannot do anything about it. They don't know your dirty secrets, and they sit you right down next to that person at the party. So now you're at the dining table, you're sat very next to the person, the last person, you don't even want to be in their shadow, let alone be with them. Now what do you have to do? This is a party that you have to also take out time out from work, but now you have to be here. Then until the end of the party, or whatever, the dinner or whatever, you have to now be there and try and make chit-chat with them, small talk. She doesn't like you, you don't like her, but this is the way it's going to have to be for the next 2 hours. I mean, I don't mean here. I hope not, at least. You're free to sit wherever you want here, okay? So, but we have all been there. We've all been there. And so we suffer silently. And it's one thing to suffer and just get it out of your system. You know, just vent it out. Make your suffering known to someone so that they can at least pacify you and talk to you and just, you know, help you, help soothe you. But then there are other times when it's just inside, it's just brewing inside and just boiling and festering, and it's incredibly difficult. But what can you do? And then we think, here's the worst part of it all. You think, she's the one. She. This. It's a sermon. I can't say anything. But thankfully you have some dirty minds, so therefore I can leave those sentences unfilled and you will fill in all the blanks. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. You are very kind. So this woman, right, who is the cause of my suffering, who is the cause of all my pains, right, she is the one who slept with da-da-da-da-da, right? And now she has the audacity to sit next to me, and now we have to just keep quiet as if nothing happened. Silent suffering. The problem is you think she's the one who's the cause of your suffering. Therefore, here's what you might do. You might ask the host. And sometimes, you know, this can happen on an aircraft. Right? You've booked your tickets, you're going to... You have a 14-hour flight, and you take your seat, and the next thing you know, oh no. So right next to you is the last person you want to be with. Not for 14 minutes, let alone 14 hours. Then what do? You might go and ask the flight attendant, please, I beg of you. I'll pay extra, I'll pay double. Can you shift my seat? Can you get me somewhere else? And then they say, sorry sir, all seats have been booked. All seats are taken, so we can't move you anywhere. What about the pilot's seat? Can I take that? See, you know you find yourself in these situations. So how come you keep facing these situations time and time and time again? You never seem to be able to come out of this. In that moment, right, in that moment where you find yourself in this problem, you try and do something about it, don't you? You don't just keep quiet. I mean, unless you're, you know, really tame and timid, in which case you might just, you know, just keep it quiet and try and get through the day, but most of the time you'll try and do something about it, especially if you know people, right? If you have the resources, if you have the means, you might walk up to someone and say, please, can I make a request? Can you move me to some other part of the room? I really don't like it, and don't ask me why. I'm just not very comfortable there. So then let's assume that they move you to another table. So now you have been shifted, right? And then you think, right, that's it. Job done, problem solved, look at me, I'm the problem solver. Problems fixed. So now you're very happy about yourself, you're very pleased with yourselves. Like you've solved the world's problems. You feel very confident, you feel like an accomplished individual who's managed to solve your life's problems, and now from here on, life's good. But soon after, yet another problem crops up. And then you have to fix that problem, if you can. And then soon after that, another one comes up. And then you have to fix that problem. Can I ask you a question, a very simple one? How many of such problems, these kind of problems, have you fixed by now? A handful? Chances are it's more than the number of hairs on your head. That many. And yet, it's never the end of it. Right? It's like when you're hungry, what do you do? What do? You eat. Do you think eating is the solution to the problem of hunger? So the thing is, we've always learned that that was the solution. When you're hungry, you eat. It's not a solution, really. It's only a, we call it a plaster. It's just a plaster over the wound. It doesn't fix the problem. Because if that was the solution, ladies and gentlemen, then once you fix it, it should be fixed for good. Therefore, eating is not the answer. Might be the answer, it's just not the solution. That's what I say, the distinction between an answer and a solution. An answer is a temporary fix. It's a plaster. But a solution fixes the problem for good, and it's gone, never to come back. So is eating the solution to hunger? Why not? Because 6 hours later? Not six? Ah, okay, sorry. Three? Two? One? It depends, right? So however many hours later, you're hungry again. Therefore, you have to again go somewhere, work hard, try and find the food that you need, cook it, wash it, all that. Eat, chew, swallow, right? Go through the whole system, whole process again to feed yourself. How many such problems do you have to go through in the course of a day, a week, a month? See, now we are at the start of a new year. This is the second week of the new year. Yeah. You have another 50 to go. Another 50 more to go. In each one of those, what will you have to do? Keep finding fixes to the same problems that you did the previous year. Hunger, bills, neighbors, relations, family, colleagues, you name it. Children, spouses. See, problems. Traffic, public transport, weather. What if another one comes? Then, economy, politics, the country, all this, the floating rupee. All these problems, the very problems that you fixed last year. What did you do in 2025? In one line, fixing problems. 24? 23? You want me to keep going? 1996? Still fixing problems. So, how old are you now? Don't answer it loud. That many years of doing what, ladies and gentlemen? Fixing problems. How successful do you feel as a human being? I ask you now, how successful do you feel as a problem solver? Do you feel accomplished? Do you feel like you have achieved, like, the ultimate solution? After how many years are you going to realize that this kind of problem solving is not going to work? How many more years shall we keep trying? See, the problem is not in your effort. It's not. You're very hardworking individuals. you're very diligent, you're very conscientious, right? You apply yourself so diligently and so meticulously. There's no question about that. I can see that, and I know a little bit about how hardworking you are, how industrious you are. Right? I know about a little bit about all that, but the problem is not about the solutions. It's the fact that you haven't understood the problem yet. In your gardens, from time to time you have weed, don't you? Weed in the garden. So when you have a weed problem, what do you do? What do you do? You uproot it. Why do you uproot it rather than just pruning it? I mean, come on, it's a simpler solution just to, you know, take a pair of scissors, just go pruning them, right? Should solve the problem. No? 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 But that's what you do in every other aspect of life. So you're a better gardener than a life's problem solver. Huh? So you're a better gardener than in most other aspects of life. See, in the garden, when you have a weed problem, you have the sense, the knowledge, the wisdom, the insight to know that just pruning this won't fix the problem. So what do? You carefully put your fingers right down to the soil, right, where the stem is attached to the soil, and then carefully, you might even just move the soil out of the way, just to make sure that none of the roots, root system still remains in the ground, and you pull it out, don't you? Yeah, and then you make sure you put it somewhere where it doesn't root itself again. Now that is what we call a solution. You know from experience that if you do that once, it's done. Why do you take a different approach to other aspects of life? Just asking, why? Is that so difficult? I mean, the concept, the principle, is that so complicated? That to get to a solution, you have to uproot it. You have to uproot it. Meaning you have to fix the problem at its roots. Makes sense, doesn't it? That's why the lawnmower does not stop the grass. If you want to stop grass from growing, you've still got to go and pull the whole thing out of the soil at its roots. But when it comes to life, we seem to have a different philosophy. Our gardening philosophy is better than our life philosophy. Well done, ladies and gentlemen, well done. So when are we going to say, take the common sense that we have in the garden? When are we going to take that indoors? Because inside your house, now this is outside, but as you're walking through your front door, inside the house, when you have a problem with your family, when you have a problem on the phone, you've just gotten off the phone with someone, or you have problems at work, you have a very different principle, a very different philosophy. That is, you try and just fix it for now. That's why at the dining table you just say, please, can you sit me somewhere else? And that is why after so many years of so-called problem solving, you still have the problems right where you are when you started. And here's what else happens. You teach these principles to your kin. You teach these solutions, this way of problem solving to your offspring. And they to theirs, and they to theirs, and so on. So therefore, we have a generation of human beings who have no idea how to solve problems. Yet, we have a generation of human beings who are good gardeners. Therefore, where our gardens have thrived, and in our gardens only grow the best of crops, In our lives, it's full of weeds. Isn't your life full of weeds? The weeds of disappointment, the weeds of despair, the weeds of anguish, the weeds of frustration. See, your life is full of weeds. So what shall we do? Shall we keep doing what we are so good at, or shall we take a different approach? You tell me. Either way, I'll teach you whatever it is you want to know. If you want to learn how to keep on doing what you're doing, but just do it better, I will bring examples from my lay life. And then we can do some knowledge sharing. I can tell you how I used to solve those problems. You can give me some of yours, right? And then we'll be on equal level. Right? I'll get off this dharmasana because it is not suitable for me to sit down here and share with you how I solve my problems back in my lay life. Right? I'll take that seat, just remove the white cloth. If anything, I'll come out of this robe and wear a sarong or something, and we'll talk. But why are we here now? You have come to some recognition, some acknowledgement, at least a little bit, that there's something wrong with the way that you solve your problems. Give me a show of hands if you have children. Children. I also have children. Almost 300 now. I have an army of children. That's what I have. Okay, thank you. So many of you do have children. Are you a better gardener or are you a better parent? Which one are you better at? Confess, right? Confession time. Put your hand up if you have more than one child. Okay, so to those who have more than one child, right? You've learned, surely you must have learned once, right? Huh? You made some mistakes the first time, then you learned. Right? We don't usually do a second time unless we have learned something from the previous attempt. Surely. See, I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt. Come on. I'm friends. We're friends here, right? Right? So usually when you take a second attempt, right, you learn your lessons from the previous time. Lessons learned. You get together as a lessons learned, and you get to lessons learned, and then you implement your second time. So, what happened the second time? Same as the first time. Can I ask those who have more than two children to put your hand up, please? I'm here again. Oh, there's still a fair few. Good. Oh, good. Right. So, ladies. So, we got it wrong the first time. That I can forgive. Let's be fair. No previous experience. So, you take a second attempt. Even in the general exams, you get three shies, right? Okay. So, the first shy didn't work. Second shy. Before you take the second shot, you at least take a few extra classes. Right? You do more papers, more past papers. Right? At least now you have that paper as well, the one you failed. That can also serve as a past paper, right? You go for more tuition. Right? You put in a little bit more effort because you realize that the previous time didn't work out. And then you take a second attempt. Right? And hopefully the second time it works out and you get a pass. But it failed. Okay, right? Let's not despair because we still have a third attempt. So we went for a third attempt. Because, you know, this is a good conversation because there are those who still stopped at two, right? And hopefully if we can share some of our knowledge and experience, the three timers, the third timers, if we can share with the second timers, right? We are doing them a service, right? So the third timers, let's share our knowledge and experience with the others. So then we went for a third attempt. Then what happened? What should we have done? Taken the lessons from the first one and the second one and gone for the third one. Right? So then by this time, Here's what I hope is the situation at home. Now that you have your third child, you don't get angry anymore. Yeah? Because you got angry the first and second time, and you learn from it, you grew from it, right? So now you don't get angry anymore. You don't get frustrated anymore. Right? When the child doesn't eat, doesn't bother you. That's like, eat if you want, otherwise, you know, sort of, don't care. Right? So, you're there now, right? They don't annoy you anymore, right? Because you've grown now, you've learned, right? First shy, second shy, this is the third shy. Any with four children? Oh, right. Any more? There's one at the front. Yes? On the way. What's that? Huh? Oh, 100. That's me. So we have 1 or 2 with 4. How did that work out? It's the same drill. But the garden? The garden's thriving. We have our flower beds blossoming. Not a single weed. Huh? And even if there was the odd weed, you would know exactly what to do with it. You would uproot it like it was going out of fashion. Right? And it would never grow again. You know, the weeds are scared to grow in your flower beds because they know that if they do, they'll have to pay with their lives. Right? But our philosophy inside the house is very different. How come you have this discrepancy? How come you have a different philosophy in your garden? Why don't we take the intelligence that we have in the garden to our lives? I mean, you never took gardening lessons, did you? Did you take a horticulture course or something? No, but you have the intelligence to know that if there's a weed, you have to uproot it. See, something so simple. Something so simple. But we don't take that approach in other aspects of life. Why? I ask you. Because I feel like you're insulting your intelligence. And I don't like it when you do that to yourselves. Not good. You know, you're bright, you're smart, you're pretty. Most of you are. So, why don't you? Why don't you apply the same intelligence into other aspects of your lives? And here's why. The reason is, you've never been taught that that is what you ought to do. The people that you took lessons from, always said, if you have this sort of problem, just fix it for now and move on. Because they were none the wiser. You've not come across anyone in your lives, ladies and gentlemen, so far, who has been able to teach you how to uproot the problems of your life. That has been the problem. All they've been able to teach you is how to prune them. And therefore the problems are always there. Temporarily, it seemed like the problems were gone. So you got through the day, you went through the day and the day was fine, but then the following day, you're back where you started. So to this day, even as parents of 4 children, 3 children, 2 children, 1 child, you have the same set of problems. I'm not going to ask you the same about relationships, because it wouldn't be nice. I'm not going to ask, okay, people who've had 1 relationship, put your hand up. That would be okay. But then if I ask, okay, people who've had to go for a 2nd relationship, I'm not going to ask that. Right? Don't be scared, I won't be asking you that question, especially not at once. Simultaneous relationships. I won't ask you that. and a third relationship or a fourth relationship or any more than that. But what did we do? Every time we got out of a relationship, we fell out of a relationship, it didn't work out, what did we do? Here's what we did. We took the same set of principles, the same philosophy, the same approach, and we went for the next one. All the while thinking, you know what? It was their fault. That's what we did. All the while moving on to the next relationship, accusing the other person for making your life difficult. See, this is why you let go of that person. Not let go of, rather you leave that person because you think it's the person's problem. It's their fault. It's their problem. Therefore, I should find someone who can make me happy. Didn't you all grow up thinking that there was this knight in shining armor? Ladies, there was one day going to come and, you know, sweep you off your feet and carry you in their strong arms, right? And then take you into a palace, into some castle somewhere, right? And then, you know, didn't you have this image growing up? Because, you know, that's what you watched on cartoon, like Cinderella. And you thought there's going to be a Prince Charming who would come and, you know, just take you away into some kind of fairyland and, you know, keep you happy for the rest of your life. These were the things you watched. These were the lessons that you learned. You know, you were too young to make sense of any of this. And, you know, we were all so gullible. So naive. But that didn't stop all those things from going and taking root in our minds. That's why, you know, you might think it's very harmless. But some of these cartoons that we show our children, right, it does them more harm than good. Because to you, it's just a cartoon. But to the child, it's understanding how life works. The child doesn't know that they're watching a cartoon. I mean, if they did, they wouldn't watch it. That's why now you don't watch cartoons. Because you know it's just a cartoon. If you knew that that was all fake, there was no point in watching any of that. Even if you did watch it, you wouldn't be enchanted by it. You wouldn't be fascinated by it. You'd just like, okay, some entertainment. But to the child, it's not just entertainment. How many kids have broken their backs trying to jump off the sofa thinking that they could also do what Superman could do? Is that because they think it's just fantasy? No, they think it's fact. That's because children are naive. So sometimes, although we think that it is harmless to show our children cartoons and some of the things that you see on there, to them, these are lessons for life. And they learn those lessons. Isn't there a particular cartoon? It's not nice for me to give names, so I will tell you what the story is. I'm sure you all know. There's a cat and a mouse. Yeah? So in this cartoon, this cat and a mouse cartoon, so the cat always tries to harm the mouse, catch it, right, play with it and tease it and all that, right? And then most of the time it fails. And then, in our minds, as we, you know, we're growing up, we watch these cartoons, right? So then, in this story, there's a protagonist and an antagonist. There's a good guy and a bad guy. So when anything would happen to the mouse, you weren't happy about that because you sympathized with the mouse. Because that was a good guy. You know, he's only a mouse. Oh, he's a cute mouse. Whereas the cat, huh? Evil, evil, evil cat. Bad cat, bad cat. But the mouse, oh. So when something would happen, something bad would happen to the mouse, your heart melted. You always wanted good to happen to the mouse. But when something bad would happen to the cat, right, everyone would laugh. That was the comedy. That was comedy. So it was entertaining when the cat got itself into problems, particularly which was a result of trying to do some harm, and it backfired. And then we would laugh about it. Usually when they do these cartoons and films, there's background laughter. Now when Charlie Chaplin's trousers fall, what happens? There's laughter. When he falls off a ladder, there's laughter. So when a lot of comedy, there's background laughter. Did you know that this is all drushtification? Sorry, I just invented that word. But, you know, this is friends and family, so I don't mind. We've invented many words by now, right? Potherization. For when it's drizzling. Drushtification. Let's go with the flow. As long as you understand what I'm talking about, right? That's fine. So, all of this is drushtification. This background laughter tells the viewer that this is something to be happy about. So when the bad guy falls into a pit, when they get into trouble, let's be happy about that. This is a lesson we end up teaching our children. At what expense, you must ask yourselves. See, you won't get them to watch a horror movie. You won't. You won't get them to watch some kind of action movie, maybe. Right? Maybe where there's gore and violence, you might not get them to watch that. What about this one? It's just a cartoon. Right? But what is the lesson we teach them? When the bad guy gets into trouble, rejoice. That's not abuse then, is it? That's not child abuse, is it? So to abuse a child, you have to always touch it, is it? Only if you touch the child, that's child abuse. But when you justify the child with all these ideas, that it's okay to be joyful when the child, when the bad guy gets into trouble, that's okay, is it? Think about it. A lot of comedy. These are, you know, some very common scenes. Man walks on the street, he slips on a banana peel and falls. What's the drushti that comes from the TV? Laugh. It's time to laugh. Now, have you not seen children who are like that in society? If someone's trousers fall, they'll laugh about that. Someone falls, they'll laugh about that. Someone gets into some kind of misfortune or some mishappening, and they will laugh about that. This is called rejoicing in another person's misfortune. At the expense of compassion. This is not what we are supposed to be doing as human beings. Let alone Buddhists. This is not what we're supposed to be doing as human beings. When the Buddha saw a group of young people attacking a serpent, he got involved. He got involved to save the bad guys. It was not the serpent that took his sympathy. It's not the snake. It was the children, the people who were striking this animal. Because the harm that they were doing was actually what was creating new harm into this universe. The harm that the serpent or the snake had done had already been done, and therefore it was merely going through the experience of suffering for the harm that it had already done. So that harm was already there. But new harm was being done, was being created. And the Buddha got involved to stop that from happening. But this is not the drishti that we get when we grow up. Every time the bad guy is not the one who we have sympathy with. We always have sympathy towards the good guy. The good guy is already good. The good guy is already good. That's not the one who needs our sympathy. They're already good. If you see someone come and shout at me, right, or someone trying to come attack me, get involved if you can. Not for my sake. No harm would come to them from me. That much I can guarantee. Get involved if you can. Try and save that person from harming themselves. You should be their friend, not mine. Because it's them, it's they who need a friend. Our friendship should be placed where it's most needed. The reason that that person would do something like that is because they have no friends. No good friends, at least. Therefore, it's time that you stepped in, got involved to be a good friend to them. But most of the time, what we tend to do is to side with those who we feel are the good guys. In most situations, we are like that. At the workplace, we tend to be like that. We take the side of the person who we think is good and talk on their behalf. We try to protect the good guy from the bad guy. The good guy is already good. What's there to protect? One's protection is one's own. If they're good, then they have already protected themselves. But the bad guy, the so-called bad guy, is the one who needs protection. Therefore, if you want to be a true friend, ladies and gentlemen, be a Kalyanamitta. Step in to support the individual who needs that help. That is why I speak out to the parents here. We often think that it's harmless to have our children watch these cartoons of various sorts, and little do we know that they grow up thinking that it's okay to be like that. And later on, you will see how it manifests when they are amongst their siblings. Then you will see when they come up to you and start complaining and saying how it's unfair that their little brother or their elder brother or their sister or, you know, someone's taken what belongs to them, and it's not fair and it's not right and all that. Looking for justice. Constantly thinking that happiness, their happiness has been stolen from them. Who steals your happiness? Is happiness something that can be stolen? Something that can be stolen has to be something you have taken from the outside. Nothing else can be stolen. Only externally acquired things can be stolen from you. See, your money can be stolen from you, yes, because you're not born with your money. Money was external. Your house can be stolen from you. Yes, your car can be stolen from you. Your wealth can be stolen from you. But what about your goodness? Your kindness? How can one steal your kindness? Your generosity? Your compassion? Can they be stolen? What about your merit? Can it be stolen? Anything that can be stolen from you is not yours in the first place. Do try and understand that, please. Anything that can be stolen is not yours in the first place. Therefore, there's nothing to steal. You just need to let go. You only suffer because you think it's yours. Not because it's taken from you. Because you think it's yours. It's not. You might be able to steal this, but I won't suffer as a result of that, because I know it's not mine in the first place. You could steal my robe. But if it causes me to suffer, it's not because you have taken it. It's because I think it's mine. But what is truly mine, you can't steal from me. Try it. Steal my virtuousness if you can. Steal my virtuousness and make me unvirtuous. Steal my samadhi, my concentration. Steal my wisdom. Steal my merits if you can. That's because those are not things I have acquired from the outside. They are not external acquisitions. They were all produced inside. They were generated here, created here. Therefore, they cannot be stolen from me. And they cannot be stolen from you either. Therefore, I urge you, invest your life in producing something that cannot be stolen from you. Invest your life in generating, creating, acquiring something, not externally, but something that cannot be stolen from you. You will thank yourselves for it, ladies and gentlemen. This is your true wealth. Things you acquire from the outside, it's just called your property. Your property. And there are property laws that govern what are the rules and regulations, terms and conditions of exchanging property. There are contracts that are formed and signed and exchanged. And they determine the regulations, rules and the terms of exchanging property. I'm not talking about property, I'm talking about your true wealth. But far too often, we spend our lives not generating internal wealth, but acquiring property. And then we claim to be rich. By those terms, the Buddha is very poor. By those terms, Jesus Christ is very poor. Are we so rich that we dare to call them poor? Are you going to suggest that Jesus was poor? Or the Buddha was poor? Then we've got the wrong yardstick. These were the richest men, the richest people, the richest individuals who ever roamed the surface of this earth. They were so rich, they didn't need money. They were so rich, they didn't need property. Certainly not to their names. See, a truly rich man is able to use what they need, yet not call it theirs. Are you there yet? Are you going to be happy with this? Let me propose it to you. I'm going to take away your house. I'm going to take away your car. I'm going to take away all these things that you call your property, but you can use it when you want it. When you need it, you can use it, but you have nothing to your name. How does that settle with you? You okay with that? Sure? Sure. Very sure. All right, form an orderly queue, please. Next week, bring in the paperwork. Okay? I will have my lawyers ready. You can write it all to the monastery. Right? You can write it all to the monastery. We will give you a place to be. Right? We will give you all three meals. Don't worry, not just before 12, you can have throughout the day. Right? Whenever you're hungry, we will feed you. Okay? You will have a place to live, a bed. You can't sleep on two beds at once, surely. You can't use three washrooms at once, so you don't need this many that you have right now. Okay? So you'll have a bed to sleep on. You'll have a plate to eat in. Okay, you'll have some furniture to use when you need it. But it's not yours, so people will share. Okay? And you're okay with that? Speak carefully. I remember your faces. This is one of the most difficult things for people to do. You know, when you go on a trip, you can share. You're okay with sharing when you're on a trip. Yeah, you'll share, you'll sleep in a common dormitory, right? You're okay to go in a bus, right? In a trip. That's a trip. A trip is a time where you share things, right? You can share, both people, two of you can eat on the same plate, right? You can share your meal, open up your batmula, and everyone can share in that. But you have to have your own little personal space, don't you? Yeah, my space, my part of the world where I can just be alone and be in my zen, where I'm the king, where I'm the queen, my palace, my bedroom, my bed. See, even at home, don't you have your own bedroom? I mean, you can't share with your own family. What are you talking about? Even at home, don't you have your own plate on which you eat? In which you eat, your own mug, your own bed, your own pillow. You know, put hygiene to a side. Okay, right, there are hygiene factors to consider, fair enough, right? Okay, so your own toothbrush and all that, fair enough. You do have your own toothbrush, right? Okay, right, so hygiene, okay, I give you that, right, fair enough. So put your toothbrush to a side, your hairbrush, okay. I don't think anyone would want to use it anyway, so let's put that to a side. But see, you need your own bed. Because that's where you feel comfortable. Your bed is not something you'd like to share with someone. Certainly not with a stranger. Why is that? Think, I want you to think. Now, at the monastery, we have a dormitory. In this dormitory that we have, there are beds. That's it. There is nobody's bed. All of those beds are nobody's beds. Therefore, anybody can use it. That's how it works at the monastery. So the way that the Buddha has taught us, very simple lifestyles, as you may know. So what we do before we go to bed, we do our night rituals, routines, whatever. We worship our teachers and do all that. Do the merit transfer, make our confessions and all that. And what do? We take off our robes, because we have the under robes, we take off the top robe and lay it out as a bedcloth. Therefore, it maintains and preserves hygiene. Right? That goes on the bed. And then we sleep. In the morning, all we have to do is remove the robe, put it around ourselves. There's no bed to make. No bed to make. All you have to do is just fluff up the pillow. What's it called, the pillow? Fluffing up. Fluff. Fluffing. You fluff the pillow, right? Just make sure it's neat and tidy. But there's no bed cloth, because this is the cloth. And we're out of bed. You know how long it takes us to get out of bed? That's it. The time it took me to do that is the time it takes us to get out of bed and move on, and then it's ready for the next person. So we don't have to spend your precious money on bed linen. So we don't have to spend your money, the money that you donate out of generosity and charity and all that to the sasana, on soap powders or soap to wash bed linen. That would be another expense. One, it would be another expense, and two, we'd be spending something far more than money. We'd be spending our time doing that. But now all we have to wash is this. This is the only time we do any washing. This one and another one. That's it. Do you know why that's possible? How we have come to the point where that's possible? It's possible because we don't claim a part of this world for ourselves. That is what makes this life a monastic life. That is what makes this life simple. Therefore, we don't need servants. But at home, you need help. You need a maid. You need a helper. You need a servant. Someone who can do jobs that you are supposed to do. This is not me pointing fingers at anyone, okay? Just saying. You know, from another perspective, someone gets a job out of it. That's good, right? So they get some work out of it, and I'm sure you are very good employees. You look after your employers, rather. You look after your stuff, and that's all good. But the fact that you need them is because you need a part of this world for yourself. Thankfully, you can afford it. But now it comes to a point in your life where you can't do without it. Therefore, you have to be able to afford it. See, now that's a trap, isn't it? Where it's fine to be able to afford it, but then if you come to a point where you have to be able to afford it, that's no longer a privilege. That becomes a necessity. And once something becomes a necessity, then it becomes the bane of your life. When you're older, of course, you will need someone to look after you. Because you won't be able to do your own things, right? You can't get from the bedroom to the washroom. You'll need someone to support you. If you don't have your children with you, a situation that I'm never going to find myself in. You know, just the thought that I'm never going to find myself in an old people's home. You know how beautiful that is? I will die amongst my family one day. I know for a fact that I will never find myself in an old people's home. Because my children will be fighting to look after me. They will take turns begging to look after me. Not because I'm so great, but because they understand that what they're doing is for their own merits, and merits that will help them on their path to Nibbana. I really hope that your children feel the same about you. I really hope and pray that your children feel the same about you. But far too often I have seen plenty of examples where children forget that they came out of a mother's womb. They forget that. They think that their birth was spontaneous. Therefore, they forget the 9 months of hardship and labor that a mother had to put through and go through. The many years of hardship that a father had to go through to protect their children, keep them safe from harm, from bad association, from hunger. They forget that. They forget that not because they are wild or wicked or vicious, it's because no one teaches them that. No one reminds them the value of doing so. See, these are the differences in our lives. Some of the differences between us. But I was born just like you did. You were. I was born to a very average family. Just as you were. I went to the same schools. I took the same lessons. The only difference is at one point we took different paths because I found a teacher. A teacher that taught me that true happiness is not something that comes out of having a part of this world to yourself. It comes in dissolving that desire, letting go of that desire to have a personal space. Therefore, when I was able to mature myself within and come to the realization that I don't need a part of this world for myself, I'm not saying that it happened overnight. It came with understanding that I didn't need a part of this world for myself. I didn't need a bed for myself, or a room for myself, or a car for myself, or a wife for myself, or children for myself, or land for myself, or a house for myself. or a plate for myself. The only reason we have stickers with numbers on our alms bowls is just so that we know where we put our stuff. But anyone's free to use it. It is so much so in the Buddhist tradition, you know, just something really beautiful I'll share with you. There are many little things like this that are so beautiful about the Buddhist tradition and the way the monastic life, right? I'll just give you one example. Customarily, when a monk gets a new alms bowl, when a new alms bowl is offered to them, what you're supposed to do is this. See how beautiful this tradition is, right? You're supposed to take it to your teacher, and then you give your teacher the new alms bowl and you exchange it with your teachers. The used alms bowl of your teacher becomes yours and your new alms bowl becomes theirs. That's the way it works. If you don't think that's beautiful, I don't know what is. You know why that's beautiful? It's for one of the reasons I explained the sermon yesterday. When you get something, you consume your merits. Yeah? Your merits are consumed. When you give something, you earn merits. We recognize that the reason that we get something is because we have prior merits. Provided that the teacher's alms bowl is still good enough to have a meal in, that is why he's still using it, then I make the most of this opportunity. How so? By making this an offering to my teacher. And by teacher, we generally tend to mean someone who is more virtuous, who is more sublime, who has more profound wisdom. Therefore, we are making this offering to someone, to some place that is higher than us. Therefore, just imagine the amount of merits we earn out of that. Because we've not come into the sasana to get an alms bowl. We've come into the sasana to not need an alms bowl in the first place. And we understand that to not need an alms bowl, you have to be someone who doesn't get hungry. And for that, you have to be someone who doesn't need a body. For that, the mind has to let go of the concept that I am an individual and an entity that needs a body, that owns a body, that possesses a body, that is the owner of a body. For that, you need more merits. Because through merits, you develop your virtue, your samadhi, and your wisdom. Therefore, what's better to do than to earn more merits out of the opportunity that you've just had? We do that quite a lot at the monastery, actually. Not just with alms bowls. Sometimes there are occasions where I go into the washroom and there's a new bar of soap. So then if people ask, where did that come from? And then it happened once, and then we started to ask, where did that, because I never went looking for one. Later we realized that a Swamin Mahanse, who was my junior, had gotten for himself a bar of soap, and he'd come and replace it with mine. That happens in a lot of places within the monastery, because we understand why we have come to the sasana. It is not to make a living. It is not for our existence. And to sustain our existence, it is to eradicate this need to exist. Therefore, for us, every opportunity is an opportunity to earn some merits, merits earned with the resolve to attain Nibbana. Now you see, when one person does that, and we talk about that, now everyone is inspired. Right? And then creatively people start to think, well, how else can I do that? What else can I do? So everyone starts to talk about that. This is the power and the beauty of noble association. One good thing multiplies. And it becomes an example to many people. So then one day something good happens, a week later, like a virus, it spreads across the entire monastery. But this time a good virus. This is how we progress every day, step at a time, to Nibbana. All the while, shedding away this need, this desire to exist and have something for myself,
have the best for myself. So you see, now it's no longer the best for myself. Because we understand that it's better to have more merit than to have a new arms both. Ping and kusal is what we have come to the sasana for. Not a bar of soap and an arms both. It's not that. But we were not always like this. And therefore I see the distinction, I see the difference, I see the change, the transformation that has happened within me as well as the people with whom I associate. And I'm throwing examples here, I'm sure you have examples from your own lives of how you are becoming more monastic. These little changes, little advances, these little improvements, they will go a long way, ladies and gentlemen. You know, one thought at a time, work on yourself, improve, become better. One thought at a time. One intention at a time, that's how we get to Nibbana. That's how you get to heaven. One intention, one good intention at a time. Like one brick at a time, you build a wall. One paving stone at a time, you build a path. Then one merit at a time, you get to heaven. Heaven can be a celestial place, or it could be Nibbana. Oftentimes when at the monastery, someone gets a new water bottle. I go through new water bottles almost every week. Usually I go into the kuti and there's a new water bottle. Then I know, okay, something's happened. Someone's got for themselves a new water bottle. So what do? They swap it with their teachers. That's a very common practice. Don't you think that's beautiful? Do you see where their focus is? It's not on the latest and the greatest. It's not on the newest. But that's not how they used to be. When the new iPhone came. I'm talking about the very individuals who are today monks, but who used to live very different lives. When the new iPhone came out, the old one was the one that was given to the sibling. Yes or no? Yes. You know how it happens at home. When the new one comes, the latest one comes, the old one is the one that gets gifted to the friend or the sibling or to the parent or whoever. But the tables have now turned because it's not the new, the latest, the greatest that they want. They realize that the greatest is not this. It's not material possession. Freedom from the need for it is the latest. That is the greatest. There's a shift. It's a paradigm shift. It's a new way of thinking. It's the freedom path. It's the beautiful way of thinking. It's the liberating way of thinking. I'm sharing with you examples because I want you to start thinking about how you could do something similar in your own little oasis that you have at home. How could you incorporate some of these into your own personal lives? I can't prescribe, I can only share and inspire. Because I don't know how it works for you at home. But if I can give you some of my own stories, these are my personal anecdotes, you can think about how they might apply to you. If your younger one or your elder one gets a new pencil case, it's your job, ladies and gentlemen, not just to give them the new pencil case or the new pencil box or whatever. That's not the only thing you have to do as a parent. How about you teach them putta? Why don't you make a gift of this? See, Malli has one, right? His is okay, it's not new, but you've got the new one. How about you give him yours? Then he might ask, why? Why would I do that? That's not what the cat did with the mouse. Then you have to have a lesson with him, a life lesson. Then you sit him down, get him on your lap, stroke his head, and say, "Putha, let me teach you a lesson. Do you know how we get things in this world? We only get by giving. See, now is the time to have a very loving, affectionate, and very enlightening conversation. This is how you can start Nibbana for your children. Nibbana starts with dana, charity. See, the 10 meritorious deeds starts with what? Dana. Paramita, dana. It's always that. Dasaraja dharma starts with dana. Get your child close to you, sit them down and explain to them, "Putha, you get because you've given. Today you are happy, aren't you? You are happy today because you've got for yourself a new pencil case. Actually, it's not just the pencil case that's new that you've got today. Aren't you happy as well? So there's two things here. One's the box and the other is happiness. What do you think that might mean then, Putha? Is it just a case you might have given, or might you not have also given happiness? Now you see, look at Malli. He's got the old one. If you give this to him, now he's still usable. There's still more life left in that. If you give this to him and swap it with his, two things will happen, Putha. One, you will give him the box, and in that process you will also give him happiness. But two, you will also encourage Malli by being an inspiration and a role model to him. Do you realize how much he would respect you after you do that? Won't he really find an ayah to look up to? Won't he remember that for the rest of his life? At least for many years to come. That my ayah looks after me. He gives me the best of life. The best of everything. Is that not better than a new pencil box, Putha? These are simple yet very powerful, impactful questions you can ask a child. They are intelligent enough to understand, ladies and gentlemen. You just need to start the conversation. This is what we do at Noble Hearts. It's just not a name. It's not just a name. It's what happens within those four walls. We nobleize hearts. That's what we do. Is that a word? It is now. We always teach our children, if you see someone without something, something that you have, be it something as simple as a pencil, give them the whole pencil. First give them the pencil and then ask them, "May I have half of it?" Ask them. Make a request. Because once it's given, it's theirs, right? See, there's a logic behind this. There's a beautiful logic behind this, ladies and gentlemen. This is what I want you to take with you. You know, these are the life-transforming, simple things that can make a world of a difference. I love talking about these things more than I love talking about the Dhamma, frankly. Because the Dhamma is merely a stepping stone. That's a means to achieve these ends. I always say humanity is the world's best religion. It's the world's noblest religion, humanity. When we are defiled by our defilements, when we are defiled by our cankers and our desires, what we lose to begin with is our humanity. Because we become me's, no longer humans. That's why sometimes people tend to do things that not even animals do. There's a logic behind why you would give the whole pencil and then ask for half of it. The reason you have the pencil and not the other child is because they've not given at some point. Because they've not given, they don't have. But you have given, therefore, you have. So now, if you can give this pencil to your friend, you have redone the merit that you have once done. That's good. I mean, that's a great start. But, hey, our job here, you know, in this world is to heal hearts and mend minds. So it's not enough for just for me to do another merit. How about we inspire the other person to do some merits as well at the same time? That's a bonus, wouldn't it? So then what do? We ask for half of it. In the process of doing that, what does the child do? The child to whom you've just given that pencil to, he breaks the pencil in half and now he gives you half of it. In doing that, he has just earned for himself some merits. See, you've not just given a gift, you've given the gift of giving. Now that is an inspiration. That is a true leader. A leader is someone who shows individuals how to become someone like them. That is why Mahatma Gandhi was a leader. That's why Jesus was a leader. He didn't just be a leader, he taught people how to become like him. How to get to the Father. There were no secrets. I mean, in greatness, there cannot be secrets, can there? If someone's great, there cannot be a secret as to how to become great. Then they cannot be great in the first place. Then, how can one claim to be great and not tell you how to become that? That can't be greatness. From the moment the Buddha attained enlightenment, what did he do for the rest of his life? He went around on foot teaching people how to become like him. No secrets. You know, he could have charged for it, couldn't he? For all the effort that he put in to discover the path, with no teacher to show him how to get there. The number of yawns that he had to strive and work so hard just to discover the path to liberation. He could have made any and every demand. He said, I will tell you, but you have to do this for me, you have to slave for me, you have to do that for me. But no. Once he had seen and achieved greatness, it was now available for the taking. Anyone and everyone who would like to, come and I will show you the path. That, in my eyes, is what greatness is. Guru Handra to me is great because he teaches us how to become Guru Handras. That is why he is great. There are no closed doors that you're not allowed to open. There are no secret chambers in which there are secret potions that you're not supposed to have for yourself. There are no truths that are only reserved for him. There are no such things. So I encourage you, ladies and gentlemen, to instill in your children the people on whom you have such a powerful influence. You may not have it for very long though, because the moment they start to feel that they are better than you, bigger than you, more intelligent than you, then you will have to listen to them. Then they'll start fathering you around. Right? But whilst you still have the opportunity, and you are still the father, you are still the head of the family, you are still the mother, and they haven't started mothering you yet, right? You still have the opportunity to shape them, mold them into beautiful human beings. Beauty is not what you see in the mirror. It's what the heart feels when you're in someone's presence. That's what beauty is. That's why it doesn't matter whether you're black or white to be beautiful. Your complexion has nothing to do with beauty. You need not wear any makeup. If you're beautiful, you are a blessing to others. Our Anagarika Mahatmyas, they don't wear makeup. But aren't they beautiful? But these were ladies who used to wear all the makeup that there was, right? It has been a big loss to the makeup industry. You know, all young women, right, in their prime years, many of them in their late teens. But now they're inherently beautiful, because that beauty comes from the beauty that comes from their thoughts, the fact that they're a blessing to others. What is a blessing? This we talked about yesterday as well. You can be a blessing when you become a source, or rather a power that attracts other people's merit. You become a curse when you attract other people's demerit. Now often people come and ask for their blessings, or ask for my blessings. Swami Nasa, can you give me your blessings? And when people do that, I wonder whether they wonder or they think that I have some kind of very special power that I can, you know, something's in this fan, I'm going to do this, they're blessed. Then take this with you. If I can give you my blessings with this, please take it with you. Or I'll cut it into many pieces and you can take one piece of this and you can go and hang it on your wall or leave it by the Buddha statue or something. If you took a piece of my robe, would that bring you blessings? I'd much rather teach you how to become a blessing unto yourself, so that you don't need me anymore. I have a problem with the fact that you still need me. I have a problem with that. I have to become dispensable in your lives. That is when you can become independent. I do not wish to be an indispensable part of your lives. That's not right. That's not how the sasana works. I'm not the shepherd and you my sheep. The objective here is to help you all become independent so that you become a blessing unto yourselves. For that you just need to be instilled and understand the Dhamma. Because the Dhamma becomes your teacher. Once the teacher is with you, you don't need another teacher. You can help, you can use help of a guide. But once you have the Dhamma, and the Dhamma becomes your teacher, then you are free to walk on your own. See, let me explain to you something I shared with the audience yesterday. Can you see this? On the back? Assume this is our karma pool. So we have lots of good things we've done, that is in the green. There are bad things we've done. Right, so we've done a bunch of good things and bad things. You've done a bunch of good things and bad things. This is what we call... Actually, this is not what we call karma. Karma is what we call it at the point where it's done. So karma only happens in a mind. At this point, it's no longer karma. Because karma is volition, right? There's no volition up here. Volition is only a function of a chitta. It's in a chitta, chetana happens. So if chetana is karma, then karma only happens in the chitta. So arahants are those who no longer function as sentient beings. Therefore, they don't have any karma. This is vipaka. But vipaka about to fruition, come to fruition. So this is kind of like an intermediary state between karma and vipaka. Essentially, this is energy. Energy that has not yet come to fruition because of one simple reason: the environment is not mature yet. Once the environment matures, then the environment attracts the right kind of vipaka. So this is kind of like a lock and key sort of mechanism. When you have the right lock, then the key responds. So the environment determines which vipaka will come to fruition. That's the way it works. Who generated and produced this? That is the mind. So for as long as ignorance and attachment lay within the mind, as the vipaka comes to fruition, it is recycled as karma. That's how this works. So you have the perceiving process, rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, jnana. But for as long as it happens on a mind where there's ignorance and attachment, that energy is not just dissipated, it is once again aggregated into what we call this karmic pool or vipaka pool, or it's an intermediary state between this stage and this stage. Clear so far? This is stuff we've talked about many times in the past. But then what determines which one comes to fruition? This is the whole thing. Now, you see, all of us have bad karma. But right now, your good karma is coming to fruition. Hopefully. You agree with that statement. So your good karma is now coming to fruition. That is because of the environment. Now, let's assume we turn up these air conditioners or turn them down, if you like, let's be turning down to 16. I don't know if that's possible. But if you did, and then you start feeling a bit chilly, that starts to draw on the bad vipaka, where you've given people chills. If you've given people chills, right, then the environment, once the environment is there, it'll start attracting those kind of vipakas, and then you start feeling a bit chilly. So what do we do in that instance? Because we are human beings, we have intelligence, we can have some kind of autonomy in picking and choosing the kind of vipaka that we attract. That is the power that we have as sugati beings. This is the power that we have as beings having been born in the sugati worlds. We can have a say in what kind of vipaka is drawn to us. That's why when you're hungry, you can go eat. If you have the means to find a meal. But there's a multitude of factors that play a part in this whole thing. But all you have to do is get the remote control and turn it up. Then what happens? What are you changing? You're changing the environment. Once you start changing the environment, then these ones stop and the green ones start coming. See, you can do it all in a matter of just changing the room temperature. Now these days I've got a bit of a cough. So, doctor's advice is to not speak. Right. I'm supposed to give myself rest. But what do I do? Anything but. So, by creating this environment, which is where I'm speaking, sometimes for hours at a stretch, what happens? I'm creating an environment to keep drawing the bad vipakas that I have produced in the previous times. Then you might wonder, am I stupid to do that? Why would I do that? Don't I have the intelligence to created the environment to draw just the right kind of vipaka? Well, that is what you have done here. You have offered Swamin Vahanse some warm water. Why? To create the environment which is conducive to good vipaka to be drawn. I could, of course, not do this sermon, which is also an option, but then what happens as a result of that? At what expense? That's the thing. When we have this sermon, your good vipaka, that starts to draw. So if I chose not to do this sermon, then what happens? My good vipaka might draw and come to fruition, but what happens to yours? Yours will have to be delayed by another week. So then, if you put that on the scales, overall, it's a loss. Gain for one person, but a loss for hundreds. Therefore, it makes no sense to do that. Therefore, I'd much rather do the sermon and then take some therapy later. This is because we understand how this works. See, in my previous life, I don't mean in my previous life, but in my lay life, I might not have decided like I've done now. Perhaps I would have thought to myself, no, my health first. Your well-being later. First, I have to go down. Next, you have to go down. Right? Like they say, put your own mask on first before you help the other person. But thanks to the Dhamma and thanks to my teacher and the association of the Mahasangha, I'm not able to think like that anymore. The way I think has changed. So now to me, it is not mine versus yours. It's the collective. So collective goodness always trumps. Therefore, now you put it on the scales, it makes far more sense to do this sermon and then to get rest later. I share this with you, not to show you how good I am. I don't think I need to show that to you. It's just so you understand how this whole the dynamics of this works, and for you to start to think along the same lines. It's an imitation. I know you're good people. And I know you can become even better than this. So put aside, put behind those days where you always used to think, what's in it for me? Because there's no me anyway. So it's not what's in it for me or what's in it for my people. It's really ultimately what's in it. That's it. What's the good that's in it? And if there's goodness that's in there, then let's try and make that happen. So then, the environment is what determines what vipakas are drawn and come to fruition. You can become a blessing by being an individual who understands this phenomenon and therefore support the creation of an environment that is conducive to good vipaka being drawn. Now, technology helps us in many ways to do that. That's, people are good inherently. They're not bad. People are good. Technologists, they do this all the time. You see, we have vehicles these days. Therefore, we don't have to walk on foot to get to places. Now, imagine if I had to come here every day on foot. 1.5 hours it takes in a car. If I came on foot, I'd have to come. No point going back home on Sunday. I just stay here. And if I had to walk, I'd be exhausted. Wouldn't even be possible to consider it. Previously we had bullock carts. Then it still took a long time. And all the shaking and all that, was still exhausting and tiring. But now you have very comfortable cars. and they're safe. You can put on your seatbelts, the cars are safe. See, human beings are able to constantly create environments which attract good vipaka. Therefore, nowadays, even if you get into an accident, provided it's not a serious accident, people will usually come out of it alive, at the very least. See, that is creating an environment. It's all creating an environment. Now in this room, we have lights on, we have temperature control on, you have a seat on which you can sit comfortably and listen to this sermon. All of this is done to give an environment in which only the good vipaka that you have done is drawn. If you are hungry, we can give you a meal so that you are not hungry throughout the sermon. This is what we call being a blessing. This is what being a blessing is all about. You are a blessing to your children. That is kind of like, you know, it's in you, it's in your DNA. It's inherently you are a blessing to your children. Because you as mothers and fathers always think about their well-being, don't you? What's good for them. Therefore, you would never intentionally do that is something harmful to them. That's why parents are inherently a blessing to their children. But you can't say the same about others. Most others will be a blessing when they choose to be. But other times they will be a, what's the opposite of the blessing? A curse. And this is why you have to pick and choose who you associate with. Because we have both good and bad in our karma pool, we have to be careful about with whom we associate. If we only had good stuff in there, then what happens? Then it wouldn't matter who you associated with, because it would, whatever it is, you will always only draw on the good vipaka. If you only had bad vipaka and no good vipaka, all bad, then would you have to be careful with whom you associated? Still not. Because no matter what they did or what you did, it would only be bad vipaka. But because you have a mix of good and bad, now you got to be careful about with whom you associate. Because you in the right hands, that's why you say, you know, you're in good hands. We have those expressions. You know, you're in safe hands, you're in good hands. What does that mean? What that means is you are in a blessing. You are with someone who is a blessing to you. Now, most times when people come up to Swami Nasa and say, Swami Nasa, please can you give me your blessings? Right? We generally tend to say something, don't we? Like, Suopatveva, may you attain the bliss of Nibbana, may you be well, right? Nivandakitva, or something like that, right? Think about why Swami Nasa says that. Then you will understand what it means to be a blessing. You know, there's nothing I can do with my hands, trust me. There's nothing that's radiating from my hand. Otherwise, I'd be like this all day. I mean, I have a cough and a sore throat right now. If I could do something with my hands, what would I be doing right now? And just keep blessing myself. I'll bless myself to good health. So then, if you come up to me and say, Swami Nasa, I'm not well these days, please can you bless me? Hello? But here's what I might do. If you come up to me and say, Swami Nasa, please can you bless me? I will say something that you understand. I will say something good. I will say something wholesome, something nice, something pleasant, something about the truth. And here's what you will do as I say that. You will think about it. Even if it is simply as, God bless you, my child. As you think those words, you think, God bless me. That's what Swami Nasa said. That's what the father said. That's what the priest said. God bless you, my child. In that moment, whatever bad, unwholesome thoughts you had in your mind would be replaced with wholesome thoughts, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it? Then now you'd be thinking wholesome things, good things, pleasant things. What have we just done? Indeed. We've just created an environment to draw on good vipaka. That's the blessing. That is the blessing. I didn't bless you. I just showed you how to become your own blessing. But you might walk away thinking, I have just blessed you. That's okay, as long as the job's done. Doesn't matter whether you give yourself the credit or give me credit. Fine, as long as the job's done. But do you see, once you understand this principle, who do you need to come for your blessings now? Do you need to come to me for your blessings anymore? No, this is what I said. I don't want to be an indispensable part of your life. I want to be a very much dispensable part of your life. Use me like a tissue paper. Once your job is done, throw it away. That's all I want you to do. Once you are done, once your job is done, once you're clean, once you're pure, once you're holy, put away, put aside the thing that made you holy in the first place. You don't need it anymore. You are holy. As the Buddha once said himself, the Dhamma is a boat on which to cross. It is not something you have to carry on your shoulders. So you don't have to have the burden of carrying the Dhamma on your shoulders. It's not supposed to be a burden. It's supposed to be the boat that gets you across. When we were young, our parents used to do everything for us. Tie our shoelaces, wash us, feed us, shelter us, teach us, all those things. But what they did, as you grew up, what did it mean to grow up? Everything that they knew how to do for you, they taught you how to do for yourselves. To the point where they became indispensable. No, they became dispensable. Now it has come to a point where you can survive without your parents. Just imagine if they became indispensable to your lives, then what would happen on the day that they would have to pass away? You'd have to go with them. This is what it means to parent. This is what it means to parent. To parent is to help become mature, grow up on one's own, to become independent. In the Dhamma, in the Sasana, it's the same principle. So this is parenting, in a way. Parenting so that you don't have to come to me. You don't have to keep coming back to me or to any teacher. Because there will come a day where our paths will, just as they crossed at one point, they will go their own way. Into nothingness. Two individuals' paths crossed, but there will come a day when, just like if you take a string, what is it you call a string with two strings wound together? Two-ply? Two-ply? Is that the word? Two-ply string? I know two-ply tissues. Strings are the same? Okay, so you take a two-ply string. If you unwind one of them, what happens to the other? Is that still wound? All right. So if you unwind one, the other is unwound in the process. So in that way, as you and your teacher progress on this path, ladies and gentlemen. Initially, the two strings on their own lost, but there comes a point where you are wound to this. You know, that's how the sasana works. So the sasana is like this one thick bundle of strings. It's a thick bundle of strings, all wound together. And that sasana is composed of individuals, just like yourselves, who are all trying to get to the same destination. So when we are lost at some point, we come and wind ourselves around this sasana. It's very strong all on its own. But that the strength of that multitude gives us the strength as individuals. And then at some point, we become strong on our own. At that point, we unwind ourselves. And then we go our own way. From something to nothing. So this is the story of the sasana. The journey of you going from someone to no one. Do what you can to incorporate this principle, but in real terms, into your lives, into your families, with your children. Like I said, teach your child to always try and share what they have, gift what they have to others. You can start at home, they can start at home with their siblings. If they get a new book, exercise book, remind them, Putta, maybe go and ask your sister, maybe she might need one, go and see whether she might want it. You know, if you can get your children into that habit of always trying to see if whatever good, the best things they have can always be gifted, gift first, use next. You know, like that gift first mentality. See if you can instill that into your children. Gift first mentality. Use next. So whenever they get something new, the question that comes to their mind first is what? How can I gift this to someone? I mean, you know, that's a blessing on two legs, isn't it? Someone who can always think like that, gift first mentality. Make that another virtue of your own lives. Have a gift-first mentality. Now at the monastery, when you serve yourselves to eat, what do? When Swami nonsense come up to you? That's the gift-first mentality. What is greatest, what is foremost, what is supreme, you offer to someone who is virtuous, someone who is noble. Not necessarily because it helps them. Not necessarily. It does, yes. But it gives you a long step ahead. It's a leapfrog on your path to Nibbana. Because this is an opportunity to honor what is good. And those are virtues that take shape in your hearts, ladies and gentlemen. You know, you don't see anything happening virtually or physically, but the transformation that it does within you, that is inexplicable. There are no words to describe that. But the goodness that you will feel will be a little bit of evidence as to what's happening inside. It's only a little bit, just the surface of what's going on. You will feel good when you do that. But that feeling good is only just the surface of the greatness that has already happened, and much of that is now here in your karmic pool. Let's not forget, we were all blessed with the human life. That's why your parents are your number one blessing. When you were merely Gandharvas, right, your parents created the environment for you to take physical form as human beings, such that today you're able to acquire for yourself enough and more merits for this journey ahead in samsara. And that is why they are the angels at home. I always talk about parents. You can't take that away from them. The fact that they're the ones, they are the reason that you and I have met today. Had it not been for them, you would not be here. They've taught you well. They've brought you up well. They've given you the best of whatever they had. Maybe they had little, but the best of whatever little they had, they gave to you. Just as today you do the same for your own children. And that is why you are a source of blessing to your children. That is the special connection, that relationship that you have between parents and children. That's why the Buddha on many occasions admired and emphasized this relationship between parents and children, and how it is vital that we make use of that opportunity while we still have it with them. They have them with us. So, you know, what's more important than understanding this is using this. There are two things in this world that are equally useless. Okay? two things in this world that are equally useless. One, knowledge that you don't have. Two, the knowledge that you have, but you don't use. They're equally useless. So if you didn't have this knowledge until now, it was useless to you. Because it was just knowledge, it was not your knowledge. But that doesn't mean that now it's useful. Unless you put it to use. That is why I always say, don't leave the classroom having learnt this and walk out as if you've not gained anything out of this. This must not be a Dhamma school. I would not expend my energy and, you know, time away from the monastery to do a Dhamma school or a Dhamma class here. It is not necessary. That's just another piece of knowledge. What matters is if you use it. So my invitation to you is now, use this knowledge at home. Start there. This gift-first mentality is a great one to start with, ladies and gentlemen. Not just start with, but one to include into your set of virtues. Encourage your children to do the same. When, you know, if they... Now, something I used to do in my lay lives, and I'm sure most of you do this as well. When you want to have a cup of tea or something, right, you will always ask the other person, anyone else you have at home, you know, would you care for a cup of tea? Can I make you one? I'm going to go fix one up for myself. Please make sure that your children learn these virtues as well. And they don't just go to the kitchen and fix one up for themselves and not think about others at home. Because when you take your tea, you consume your merits. If you make one for someone else, you earn merits. The math is simple. At the end of that cup of tea, you want to be richer than poorer. If at the end of that tea, all you've had is consumed one merit, then you're not going to have another tea. Because one merit cannot be used twice. They're expendable. You are an island, ladies and gentlemen. You are an island. Don't forget that. You must cultivate your island. It's very important that you cultivate your island. Weed out as much as possible all the bad stuff. Actually, the best way to try and do that is to attend Margapala. Fruition. Come to noble fruits. Right? Because there are only two ways in which these vipakas can be consumed. One is when they come to fruition. The other is when it... What's ahosi? What's the English term for that? Banned? I'll find the word out for next week. But you know what I mean? Madam? Negated? Okay, I'll go with that for now. So it's basically where, the principle is this, where there is no longer an environment for which they can come to fruition. You see, once you become a sotapanna, you are no longer born in the four great hells. It's impossible to be born in the four great hells. Therefore, any vipaka that was due to come to fruition in the four great hells is now negated. That is what we call ahosi karma. Meaning the karma was done. It was always there in the pool waiting for the moment to mature. But now, because the environment, the complementary environment, will no longer manifest, there is never again the opportunity for such vipakas to come to fruition. So then this brings us to an important point. If there are only two ways in which your bad karma can be expired, because they have no expiry date, it'll be there forever, until the environment is ready for it to come to vipaka, come to fruition, then you'd much rather do what? Get it to become ahosi, right? Because what's the alternative? For it to come to fruition. Because when it comes to fruition, what happens? You suffer. So these are the only two ways in which this can happen. Either it has to come to fruition, or it has to be negated. Meaning the environment is no longer or never again going to be there to attract such vipaka. That's why you must understand that there's only one path out of this. If you want to be free from the consequences of your previous bad actions, I can only see one sure and short, guaranteed way out of it without having to go through each of them and expire them. Now, there were sasanas, contemporaries of the Buddha, whose teaching was, whatever bad you've done, you're going to have to suffer. You're going to have to pay the price. There were teachers, religious teachers, who are the Buddha's contemporaries, whose philosophy was that, if you've done good, you will enjoy the rewards of that, but if you've done bad, you will have to suffer. But the Buddha denied that. He said, no. No, that's not necessary. There's a way to cheat the system. The Buddha is the biggest fraud. Don't you just love him for that? Here's a man who teaches you that although you've thrown all these rocks up in the sky, there's a way that they don't have to come falling on your head again. I'm yet to come across another teaching, another philosophy that shows you how to escape your own bad actions and the consequences of that. In the Buddha's teaching, I found that, I discovered that, that it's possible. Because if this is how it works, if the environment always draws on the vipaka of your previous karma, then the only way to be free of those bad vipakas from coming your way is to not create the environment. Now, I spoke to you a moment ago about blessings. I cannot give you a blessing, but I can say something good, say something wholesome for you to think about as you walk up. Now, you know, even when you walk up and worship the Swaminarayan, that is also earning you merits. So that in itself is the blessing. It's not me doing anything really. Although you give me credit for it. I'll take the credit. Thank you. But actually you're giving me credit for something you're doing to yourselves and for yourselves. I want you to feel empowered, ladies and gentlemen. I don't want you to feel that you're my slave and I'm your savior. I'm not. My savior is the Dhamma, and so it is yours. That's why you cannot go and escape this by becoming my followers. Don't follow me. Do what is right. Because I'm following nobody. I'm practicing the Dhamma. I have no savior. I take refuge. Refuge in the Buddha. Buddha is the truth, the destination, freedom from all this. Dhamma is the doctrine, the philosophy that helps me understand this. And Sangha is the practice. So ultimately, who's my refuge? Atta dipa viharata. Atta sarna na anya sarna. Make yourself your own island. Realize that you are your own island. You are your own refuge. There is no other refuge. Na anya sarna. That's what na anya sarna means. There is no other refuge. Make yourself your own abode. This is yourself. You're good, you're bad, and the environment you create. So when I give you a blessing, or so you think I give you a blessing, what I just do is remind you that you are your own blessing. So I say, Supatteva. So in your mind you're thinking, Supatteva. Now as you're thinking, Supatteva, what's happening? There's an environment for Supatteva. So then that draws attraction, or that draws vipaka, that helps you to be what? Supatteva. What did I do? I hardly did anything. Supatteva is, may you be well. See, the fundamental teaching here is, you are your own refuge. I wish I could do this for you. If I could, I would, trust me. Because there is nothing more joyful than walking this path of freedom to liberty, to liberation. There's nothing more joyful than that. So if I could do it for all of you, I would, ladies and gentlemen, trust me, because it is so joyful walking this path. Every single day, as we get closer and closer to liberation, right? Just the journey is so beautiful. I can't imagine what the destination must be like. If the journey is so good, I just can't imagine what the destination must be like. So if I could do this for all of you, I would. Just for the sheer fun and joy of it. Not necessarily out of sympathy for any of you. Just for the sheer joy of it, I would. In fact, I'd say, no, don't you attend Nibbana, let me do that for you. I would make it my duty, my responsibility, and my joy and my privilege to do it on your behalf. But I cannot. Therefore, all I can do is tell you what I do for myself. So, who is your blessing? Yourself. Can I give you a blessing? Shall I? This sermon was the blessing. Nothing more. Because what have you come out of this sermon having understood now? That you are your own blessing. That is the blessing. That is the blessing. Now you see, if your children are going through some kind of hardship or some bad time, you know, they've got an exam coming up, or you know, your children are going through some kind of a tough time. Maybe, you know, they're married or whatever and they're going through a difficult period. Parents who don't understand this, what do? They organize a dana at their home, not the children's home. Children aren't invited because they're not interested in this kind of stuff, right? Then they go to the Bodhi Puja, they go to the Devali, they do this, they do that, they make offerings, and they say, now I want to transfer all these blessings to my children. Like, how? Tell me how you're going to do that. And then you know what I'm going to do. I'm going to stop doing all these merits and I'm just going to come and ask you for merits and blessings. If that were possible. So your children have an exam coming up. What are you supposed to do as parents? Do the Bodhi Puja, right? Go to Anuradhapura. Do a Bodhi Puja. Let children be at home. Like they're watching, watching TV. The exam is in a week's time. You go to Anuradhapura, do the Bodhi Puja, right? Offer the Atapirikara, do a Dhani and all that, and sit down under the Bodhi tree and then transfer your merits to them. Like a money transfer. You know, you can't do merit remittances. It doesn't work like that. It doesn't work like that. I'm sorry. I mean, I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad news, but it doesn't work like that. So then you say, yo, all this time I've just wasted my money, all this time I've wasted an effort going all the way to Andhra, and I thought I was transferring merits to my children. No, you haven't wasted anything, because nothing was a waste. What you did was yours. Here's the little that they would have acquired out of it. You coming back home and showing them the pictures, and then say, Puta, see, this is what Ammi and Tati did for you. Right? We went there, we did this, we did that. So they're still watching TV. Is it? Oh, what? Oh, good. All right, so don't bother me, I'm watching TV. Old people. So whatever merit they would have earned out of that, that's theirs. But the Bodhi Puja, who is that for? That's for you. The Atapirikara, that's for you. The almsgiving, that's for you. Sometimes they earn more demerit in the approach that you took. Because you thought they might be happy with what you did for them, and you go and tell them, and what they say, ma'am, wasting my time. And now who are they bad-mouthing? The Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, and whatever meritorious deed you might have done, and the parents. I mean, that's a cocktail for disaster. Not only are they bad-mouthing the parents, but the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, and the meritorious deed that you have done, all of that bad-mouthed in 1 minute. Now you are not the blessing. What you've just done is been a curse to them. Much rather, you didn't do that in the first place. See, this is why there are no shortcuts. If you let your children spoil in their formative years, and then once they are, you know, all grown up, and now you want to try and fix them up somehow, right? It's gonna be a long, arduous journey. Once a jelly has settled in the fridge, right? After that, you can't put the fruits inside. Because now you have to damage it to do that. Now you have to destroy the structure. Then it becomes incredibly difficult. That's why it's far better to do it while it's still in the cooking, while it's still in the pot, while it's still simmering, while it's still on the stove. It's better to do it then. That's why Guru Ramdas is going on and on and on and on about how you rear your children and bring them up and do what is right by them. And your duty is not just giving them life, but giving them a reason to live. Most parents stop at giving their children life. But I want you as good parents to give them a reason to live. That is far more important. Because if you don't give them that, then that life will be a waste. So be noble parents. That's what I want you to be. Noble parents. Not just parents. Cats and dogs can be parents. It's very biological. Be parents. That's a biological process. What I'm talking about is a spiritual process. Bring in spirituality into your homes. You don't need a Buddha statue at home for that. I'm not inviting you all to become Buddhists. I'm inviting you to be spiritual, not religious. Spiritual. Be spiritual. Have an element, a dimension of spirituality in every home. As the mother, it is your duty, ladies. You are the source of love at home, aren't you? That's why we always look up to our mothers. The mother is a source of love. She's a source of compassion. So bring an element of spirituality into your homes. Be the Sri Akanta at home. Fathers, you are the source of protection. So protect. That is your duty. Protect. That is why a child needs both mother and father. An abundance of love and compassion, as well as protection. To protect while they're still young, immature, tender, and love and compassion to give them the right ingredients to grow under their protection. And once they are grown and they're strong and they can stand on their own 2 feet, then they no longer need their protection because now they're strong. At that point you can remove that protection and then they can go on to be protectors to others. Then they don't need the father's shelter. Once they become their own source of love and compassion, then they don't need the mother. But until then, both mother and father have a role to play. These two elements is what I call spirituality at home. Spirituality at home, not religion. You can do your religion, that's besides this. If you want to be have a Christian or Catholic environment, have that. If you want a Hindu environment, have that. If you want a Muslim and Islamic environment, have that. If you want a Buddhist environment, have that. That's out of this. It's not the question here. This is about bringing spirituality, these principles. The gift first mentality. I used to be in the Parisarabhata Kanda when I was younger at school. I don't know what they call it in English. Parisarabhata. Don't they have it now in schools? Parisarabhata? Huh? Environmental society. We had an environmental society, but then they brought out Parisarabhata. Like we were sort of like a scouts environment for the environment. So when we were younger at school, we were taught for every tree that you cut down, you had to plant another. So that was where I learned that principle. For every tree you cut down, you plant another, at least another. Don't you see the significance of that here? For every merit you consume, must we not plant another? So for every alms bowl we receive, must we not plant another? Therefore, gift that alms bowl to the teacher and take theirs. I want you to encourage your children to see those without as an opportunity. Those who are underprivileged, it is not a menace to have them around. It's an opportunity to have them around. What is it an opportunity for? To give. To gift. Because if you have a gift first mentality, right, then you are your own blessing walking on 2 legs. Make use of that opportunity. Teach your children to see the world in this way. I mean, unless you teach them, they won't. Trust me, unless you teach them, they're not going to think about this spontaneously. It's not going to come to them, you know, from some divine power or whatever. You have to be that source of divinity at home. You are their divine power. It is you. Teach them that. As you teach yourselves, teach them that. Now I want you to do this over the course of next week. Think. Be creative. Look at these opportunities. And I've given you 1 or 2 examples, but you can think of plenty. Like the example I gave yesterday's sermon. At home, when my father got back from work, those days it used to be a hassle for me, but today I realized what an opportunity it was. When my father got back from work, it was my job to take his socks off, to let him relax, to help him relax. So he would come and put his feet on the armchair, and then it would be my job to go and take his socks off. Those days it used to be a hassle. Today I realize what an opportunity that was. This is just an example for inspiration. When mother would come back home from shopping or whatever, we would run up to her, take the bags, mostly to see what was in there. But I recall, I would bring it all back into the kitchen myself and my brother, and then we would just, you know, stack things in the shelves and put things in the fridge so that mother could relax. Don't you think it served me well? Those little bits, they all add up. Look at where I am today. This is not the effect of one cause. This is many causes aggregated. Like this roof doesn't stand on just the bricks that lay under them. They're supported by many layers of bricks. Some nowhere near the roof. Many of them are just by the foundation. But they all support to keep the roof up there, right? In the same way, what you see here on stage is the product of many little things done over a period of time, continuously, repeatedly, consistently. So I say that's one example. When you get back from work, do try and encourage your children to come and at least ask you, Amma, can I get you a cup of tea? Can I bring you some water? Perhaps, you know, get them into the habit of having a glass of water ready so that you could have it when you get back home. You know, maybe the amount of merits they can earn at home are limited compared to what I get at the monastery and the children at our monastery get. But still, like I always say, parents are the Rahatan Mahanses at home. These are the Rahatan Mahanses at home. You must not deprive your children of that opportunity. And I know you won't deprive them of that opportunity intentionally and deliberately, but what I'm asking you to do is deliberately ensure that they capitalize on that opportunity. Because they won't have you forever, unfortunately. Sometimes it may be that they will realize it once it's too late, just as some of you do now. Now it's too late. Now you can't turn back the clock. Little chores that they can do at home? Yeah, you know, we have technology now, so you have the washing machine, you have all these things, and you have maids at home and all that. Yes, but still, I'm not suggesting that you throw it all out and, you know, go back to Stone Age. That's not what I'm suggesting. But what I'm saying is, if you can be creative, but first you have to explain, maybe they won't understand the full depth of this profound principle, but they will still understand the gift that you get is a gift that was given. That they will understand if you lovingly, affectionately take the time to explain to them. I think they will. You know, they're your children after all. You know, if you're good, then the seeds are good. So it can't be that they're all that bad. You're not all that bad. Only a little bit bad, but not that bad. So don't give up on them. Just because they're grown up, just because they're now mature and they're taller than you, bigger than you, don't give up on them. You've done only half of your job by giving them life. But the other half is to give them a reason to live. I keep coming back to children because they are the next generation. You know, some of you are set in your ways. It's difficult to change some of those ways because, you know, many years of layering over the other, and many types of indoctrination and many situations into which you've gotten yourselves, and now it's difficult to take you out of them. It's challenging. Although sometimes you understand the truths, it's difficult to now enact them, put them into practice. But for your children, not necessarily. And I know that you care deeply about them. I know that you do. I know that you're always in this place, which is, if I can't get what is best, at least my children should. That, I think you're all there. So that being said then, I will encourage you from time to time at least, while I tell you on some occasions, you know, children, this, that, the other, put them all to a side, get to your Nibbana. I will say that in one sermon, and in the next sermon I will say, do something for your children as well. So, you know, it's a kind of, we have to balance this act. Because let's be honest, you still have the duty of being parents. Right? So, But remember that when I say do this and that for your children, I'm also saying in the same vein, do it for yourselves as well. So if your parents are still alive, in whatever state of health they might be, please remember that it has an expiry date. This opportunity has an expiry date. So don't let that go by. Those are the Arahatun Vahanses at home. I cannot emphasize that enough. They are the Arahants at home. You can't get better than that unless you come to the Sasana. You can't get better than that. Serving your boss is nothing compared to serving your mother. Nothing in comparison. But your boss will give you a pay rise. Your boss will give you a car. Your boss will give you a promotion. Your boss will give you opportunities to go abroad. They will give you a title. Therefore, the world might tell you, people you associate with might tell you, you know, forget about home, right? Anyone could do that. Let your sister look after her. She's old anyway, right? Go and make use of all these opportunities. Rise the career ladder. Go and serve your workplace. Be with your boss, right? Do whatever you have to do to get up the ranks. That's what people will say. That's because they don't understand any of this stuff. Frankly, to your boss, you're just a number. Numbers have a funny way of having more on either side. Every number has a number on either side, right? That's why it's called a number line. But your mother to you, just a number. When one is gone, do you get another one? Was there one before her? No. She's not just a number. She's mother. Your father is not just a number. He's father. One. There's only one of them. So at least consider what I'm asking you to do. It may be that you spend far more of your time investing your life at the workplace than you do looking after the people, the very people that created this opportunity for you to come to human life. You have a job today because you were born human in the first place. I was very good at what I did in my workplace, but no sooner than I left the company, they got someone else to fill my vacancy. And they're probably doing a better job than I did. That's how the world works. Out with one, in with another. So we are not indispensable to the workplace. No matter how they might make you feel, right, they will give you praises and honors and awards and accolades and titles, and then they will bring you up on the stage and say, this man, he is the one who brought our organization from what it used to be to what it is now. Ladies and gentlemen, a round of applause, please, they will say. They will make it sound like you are the bee's knees. Don't fall for that, into that trap. They'll put you on a plane and they'll send you off to some fancy holiday and make you feel like you are it. The whole company only survives because of you. It's a company. Doesn't the name tell you what it is? It's not Youpany, right? It's a company. A company is the coming together of individuals. So when one wheel falls, another one replaces it. So your loyalty must lay to your family, number one. I'm not saying do any disservice to the workplace that feeds you, that gives you your paycheck, that puts a roof above your head. I'm not suggesting that, not one bit. Be loyal. Be truthful. Be righteous. Do what you're supposed to do. But remember, there has to be a boundary. Most times people forget and they sacrifice what cannot be regained in the pursuit of what is there in abundance. People tend to do that a lot. Their families suffer, their relationships suffer, parents suffer, children suffer, spouses suffer, siblings suffer, health suffers. What examples do you have for this? Huh? You know who I'm talking about. Not you. You know the cost. You sacrifice all these things that you cannot gain back. Things that are once gone are gone. So please be mindful about these things. Yes, it's not the Dhamma that we spoke of much today. But this is not a Dhamma school after all. It's a school for life. These are some of those truths that people will barely tell you, because telling you these things is only going to be disadvantageous to them most of the time. I don't think at the workplace they will tell you much the kind of thing that I just told you now. On the contrary, they'll probably tell you the opposite of that. So when people try to put you on a pedestal, remember that they put you on the pedestal, therefore they can quite as easily pull you down. Whatever forces put you up are the same forces that can pull you back down. Every maintained thing is there because of causes. That's why they're called sankata, that's why they're called conditioned manifestations. Whatever title you hold, whatever position you hold, whatever prestige you hold, please remember this. Right? It's one thing to feel that you're prestigious and you have fame and you have glory and all these accolades and those titles and everything that your people at the start, your workplace give you, right? And society gives you, and you can hold your chest high, hold your head high, and you walk like, you know, you are the Don, right? But please remember that all of that is maintained. All of that is the product of causes. One cause changes and everything collapses. There's a little story, I'll end with that. This story I heard from one of our Swami Nivasis in one of his sermons. He's half my age. So you see, wisdom doesn't always come with age. So there was this once there was this man who wanted to get married. And then he came up with a list of friends that he wanted to invite to his wedding. And then he asked his father to send the invitations out. So he had a list of about 50 names, and he asked his father to make the invitations. So along came the wedding day. And on the day of the wedding, there were only 5. How many were invited? Or at least he thought, 50. So now he was quite annoyed by this, naturally. So he goes up to his father and asks him, "Dad, where are my friends? I gave you a list of 50 odd names. Only 5 have turned up. Did you not send the invitations out?" So the father smiled and he replied. He said, "Son, I did bring all 50 of them. But I didn't tell them that it was your wedding. I told them that you were in trouble and you needed help." "Son, you don't have 50 friends. These are your friends. Lesson for life." Okay. Lesson for life. You don't have 50 friends, ladies and gentlemen. Not everyone who accepts an invitation to a party is your friend. Friends are those who stick around after the party. After the party is over, to wash the dishes, to clear up, to clean up, so that you don't have to do all that on your own. Those are the true friends. When you're a mess, the people who come forward to fix you up and don't abandon you, those are the true friends. You'll be shocked to find out that all these people that you call your friends are not really so. People don't care about you as much as you think they do. Sorry. And they care far more about themselves than you think they do. That's a good one, isn't it? Before we conclude, I have a couple of videos to show you. So I'll show you the first one first. You were all invited to the monastery on the 21st Sunday last month. We had a meditation program. And we have produced a short video of the event, because I want you all to, one, rejoice in the goodness that happened on the day. And if you were there for the second half of the day, I came around just to see how you were doing. And I came and listened to the discussions you were having with the Swaminarayanas, rejoicing in all that goodness that was happening. I was there just to remind you that in that occasion, it was not I who was the teacher. You were in safe hands. If you were there, ladies and gentlemen, you would have witnessed, you would have experienced the care, the effort, the love and affection with which, and the clarity with which they taught you the same doctrines, the principles, the Dhamma that you learn here every day. And there you found an opportunity to ask questions, to clarify some of the things that you may walk away only half-baked, not the full thing. See, that is not something I can ever do. You can think of me as a doctor if you like, but the nurses are the ones who heal you up to good health. It is in their presence you will be healed. Guru Har Gobind always says that here is your teacher, but it's more like he is your guide. The presence of Mahasangha is where the beauty happens. That's where everything is. That's where the magic happens. So I walked in that day just to see how beautifully you were there in those groups discussing the Dhamma, clearing those doubts, and how they were taking various props and trying to help you understand anicca, dukkha and anatta. And I listened to you asking those questions. And I was feeling sorry for the Swaminarayanas on some occasions. As they were looking at me wondering, what have you taught them? But you know, this is how we progress on the path. So well done for those of you who are able to make time. I know not everyone is always able to do that. Various commitments and obligations always come up, and a trek all the way to the monastery is not an easy one. Of course, I understand that. If I lived in Colombo, I would experience what you experience whenever we invite you there. But for those of you who made the effort to be there on the day, it was World Meditation Day after all, recognized by the United Nations, and all the brainchild of one of our own sons of our own soil. And he was there on the day. He's amongst you as well, one of our Rajagirians. So I have a short video. I want you to watch that. Rejoice in the goodness that happened on the day. And after that, I'll show you another one before we conclude the sermon. Let's watch the next video as well. You were there last Sunday for a very special event. A special event that was to mark the beginning of the end for people around the world. The end of suffering. Little Britain started here. This was the ground on which we all got together and made a resolve that it is not just us who must be privy to the Buddha's teachings, because it is not reserved for a certain race, creed, religion, faith, or belief system. It is the truth of this universe. Therefore, if you are part of the universe, then the truth awaits you. And it is with that resolve we made a start. If you remember, it was just an idea in a mind. And then we talked about it. We shared it with each other. You went to great lengths, ladies and gentlemen, to get to the point that we were able to get to on Sunday the 4th. Because initially it was just a dream. We knew somehow we could do it, but the way that it was going to happen was just a question mark. But where there was a big question mark, what you Rajagirians did was filled it with answers, filled it with ways in which we could make it happen. And so finally, as we hoped we would be able to do at the turn of the new year, we all got together to lay the foundation stone of the International Language Center. And I want all of you to rejoice in what you are about to see. This is not one man's doing. This is not Guru Andhra's doing. This is not my doing. This is what happens when like-minded people who realize that their purpose is to serve mankind. This is what happens when people realize that they can be a blessing to draw the good merits of other people and bring forth that good merit so that they can be healed. This is what happens when we all do that. So please rejoice in this. And take full credit for what you're about to see. This is the start of something beautiful. It's not so little after all, is it? We call it Little Britain. It's not so little after all. What is little about the thoughts, the words, the actions, the intentions, and the deliberations that you have made to get this far? What's little about it? That compassion is abundant. That is the beauty of it. I remember like it was today, the day I announced this project, there was only one thing I asked from all of you. Do you remember what that was? It's not the pennies in your pockets. I said that will come from wherever it has to come. It's not the penny you see in your pockets, ladies and gentlemen. It's the passion in your hearts. That is what is needed. It's not money that makes things happen. It's will. It's intention. It's blessings. It's people's intentions, people's hearts, people's desire, people's wants, people's determination to make something happen. So for every phone call that you would have made, for every friend that you would have asked and talked to, for every link you might have shared, for every word that you might have spared, it is not I who is going to thank you. The whole world will thank you one day. The whole world. On the same day we launched the truth, these universal truths in 27 different languages. And you were there to witness that as well. I will have a video of that shortly, so that we can rejoice in that once again. But what we have started to build is the sanctuary where these talents will be fostered and nurtured Many more languages will be added to our list. I can see Bulgarian coming along soon. It's not on the menu just yet, but it will. 27, including sign language. Imagine that. Sign language. The fact that someone's willing to talk to those who can't hear, speak to those who can't hear, and learn the language so that those who are not that way abled can still be abled with the Dhamma. That's compassion. That's why this is an oasis of compassion. The monastery that you have built is an oasis of compassion. So I encourage you all to continue being part of this journey. Yesterday, when I showed this video to the people at the monastery, the devotees, I made sure to mention the Dharmishtha Rajagirins because I wanted them to recognize that there's a beautiful community here. Just another but smaller version of them. The only difference is there we give the sermon in Sinhalese, here we give a sermon in English. In every other way, it's all the same. There you have people who care, here you have people who care. There you have people who go the extra mile, here you have people who go that extra mile. No difference between them. That is who you have become. But you were very soft clay. I didn't have much to do as a potter. It took very little work for us all to be where we are today and to get us all here, to get us all to a point where today you have invested in a center, in an establishment that will serve for many decades to come, not for your own gain. Let's assume this place takes another year to build up. And then we will continue to train our monks and our anagarikas. Let's assume that takes another year. And let's assume in another 3 to 4 to 5 years we start delivering what we promised. At that scale, we're already doing it. Right? Proof is in the pudding. We have the 27 language channels already, even without the center. That means with whatever little we have, we will always do the best we can. You help us do it already. This is only to take it to a bigger scale because the whole world needs that now. And a few of us cannot meet the demand that is out there. But I know that deep down in your hearts, you know that it is not you who's going to benefit from this center. And that is just beautiful. This is not a center that's going to feed you. This is a center where you're going to be feeding others. That is beautiful. That's just remarkable. It's selflessness in action. When you know there's nothing to gain out of this. If we were building a kitchen, we could say that I would also get a meal out of it. If we were building a washroom, we could say that we would also be using it. But what are you building here now? A center in which languages will be learned, will be spoken. Languages that you may not even understand, not a word of it. But yet, you have invested yourself, your love, your energy, your wealth, whatever. Your friends, your friendships, your relationships. You have invested in this to make this a reality with absolutely no gain expected out of it. Sadhu, sir. To that, I raise my hat, although I don't have one. That is truly Dharmishtha. So it's not just a name. I think you have earned yourselves the title. Well done, Dharmishtha Rajagirians. Well done. Let's do the merit transfer and conclude for the day. Let us all take a moment then to transfer all the merits that we have all acquired today by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem. By inviting the Swami to deliver the sermon as well as listening to the Dhamma, contemplating the Dhamma, and creating a conducive environment for all to come along and practice the path. Let us take this opportunity to transfer all these merits that we have acquired To Guru Swami Mahansa, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery, let us take this opportunity to transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas throughout the world, who have made it their life's resolve to propagate the Dhamma as well as practice the path to seek their own liberation and help others along the way. Let us transfer this message to the Mahanayakas, the Anunayakas of all the chapters, who make every effort to help the sasana thrive and to prolong it for eternity. Let us also take this moment to transfer this message to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side to look after you in times of distress, in times of adversity. They have always been your guiding light and given you protection and shelter when you most needed it. Let us also transfer this message to your mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, friends, acquaintances, teachers, employers and employees, anyone and everyone who helped you, supported you, assisted you in any way, shape or form, reminding ourselves that it is in their compassion and in their loving kindness we have been able to enjoy the comforts of life as we have done. And therefore, out of compassion and a sense of gratitude, let us transfer all these merits that we have acquired to all of them. May by the power of these merits they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the Sakkadeva as well as all the divine beings who have protected and preserved the Sambuddha Sasana and who continue to do so. Let us transfer this message to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they also be freed of any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer this message to those who passed away in our name, our forefathers, our ancestors, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life as we do and practice the path in peace and harmony. Let us also transfer this message to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation. Let us also transfer this message to those who lost their lives to natural disasters and calamities such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on, as well as those who lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe. Reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been parents to us, friends to us, siblings to us, those who will have gone the extra mile on our behalf and sacrificed in abundance for our happiness and well-being, and therefore with an abundance of compassion, loving kindness and a sense of gratitude for all that they have done for us, let us transfer these merits to all of them. And by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful planes, may they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May by the power of these merits they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I and everyone who has helped make this program a success become arahatan vahanse, an arahat theranin vahanse, in this very life itself and in the era of the Sri Sambuddha Sasana itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. And the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you. Raga ginnang nidatnva Dvesha ginnang nidatnva Moha ginnang nidatnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetnva Raga gini niveva,
Keshagini Neveva Mohagini Neveva Nivansata Neveva Nivansata Neveva Nivansata Neveva තුනුරුවන්ගේ සූවිසි අනන්ත මහා ගුණ බලෙන් සියලු ලෝක සියලු සත්වයෝම නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුප්තදර වෙත්වා. සාදු සාදු සාදු.